headlines. Iran says unilateral sanctions imposed on the country, especially bans on medicine and humanitarian items, kill many children and amount to crimes against humanity. Iran tells the EU foreign policy chief that it will not back down from its red lines in the Vienna negotiations, blaming the West's lack of serious will for prolongation of the talks. Also, Palestinian resistance movements condemn Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Bahrain, saying such trips will never legitimize Israel's occupationist policies. Thank you for joining us. Iran's deputy ambassador to the United Nations says unilateral sanctions against her country amount to crimes against humanity. Zahra Ershadi denounced the sanctions on medication and humanitarian goods. She said a lot of Iranian children have lost their lives due to drug shortages caused by such inhuman bans. The Iranian envoy stressed that countries which impose sanctions on other nations should not go unpunished. Ershadi emphasized that her country demands an immediate halt to all coercive measures, including imposing sanctions. She said a removal of sanctions on Iran can provide the country with guarantees for achieving economic and social development. The United States has imposed illegal sanctions against Iran with the aim of crippling its economy. It further stepped up the bans after unilaterally withdrawing from the 2015 deal. The Iranian president says Tehran is seeking a real removal of anti-Iran sanctions in the Vienna talks aimed at restoring the 2015 deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Ebrahim Raisi says the rights of the Iranian nation must be respected. He made the remarks in a meeting with the Irish foreign minister in Tehran. Simon Coveney, for his part, said the Iranian nation's lack of trust is due to Washington's failure to abide by its pledges and thus understandable. He said Dublin believes that other parties to the JCPOA should offer necessary guarantees to Iran during the Vienna talks if they are seeking to revive the accord. Coveney is on an official visit to Iran. Earlier on Monday, he also met with his Iranian counterpart. During a presser with Coveney, Hossein Amir Abdullahian urged seriousness from other parties in the Vienna talks.
We believe that if the U.S. and the three European countries show seriousness in returning to the full implementation of their commitments under the JCPOA, reaching a good agreement in a short time is achievable.
Amir Abdullahian said Iran is serious in hammering out a good deal within the framework of the JCPOA. He said Tehran is keen on reaching a swift agreement which will secure Iran's national interest. He also noted that the American side sends messages of goodwill, but practically doesn't take any tangible actions. Amir Abdullahian also urged Western powers to stop what he called playing with time. The top Iranian diplomat also discussed the Vienna talks with the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell. Borrell said the negotiations have reached a crucial point, urging flexibility from the parties involved. Amir Abdullahian, however, stressed that Iran will not comprised with its red line in the talks. He also criticized the Western signatories for prolonging the talks by showing a lack of serious will. Earlier, we asked history professor David Yagubian about Tehran's insistence on the actual and verifiable removal of sanctions against Iran.
Iran entered into the negotiations regarding its civilian nuclear energy program with the Obama administration for one thing, to achieve one thing, and that was sanctions relief. Unfortunately, the Obama administration never lived up to its commitments, and I believe that President Raisi, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, the foreign minister, they're concerned that basically what is coming will be a repeat of 2015, where there was ostensibly goodwill in the air, and the United States was going to meet the commitments that it had signed onto on paper. And instead, what we saw was the Obama administration reneging on U.S. commitments, maintaining the sanctions, and therefore not enabling Iran to benefit from the agreement that it had signed onto. And I think that it's very important that the Iranian negotiating team remain vigilant at this stage to make sure that certainly what is coming, and that is an American attempt to weasel out of its commitments, is not going to be humored. The Iranian negotiating team has been crystal clear throughout all of the negotiations in Vienna regarding Iran's primary demand. And if this demand for verifiable, sustainable sanctions relief is not met, then the JCPOA will simply not be returned to.
Palestinian resistance movements condemned the Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Bahrain. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum said such visits can never legitimize the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. Barhoum held Bennett responsible for the atrocities Israeli forces commit against Palestinian people. Also, the Islamic Jihad movement has strongly condemned Bahrain for hosting the Israeli Prime Minister, saying such trips bring nothing but threat and danger to Arab states. Bennett arrived in Manama on Monday and will meet Bahrain's Crown Prince and Prime Minister during his two-day stay in the country. Meanwhile, hundreds of people rallied in Manama to voice solidarity with Palestinians and denounce Bennett's visit, which coincides with the anniversary of their 2011 uprising against the Al-Khalifa regime. Bahraini political activists in Iran have held a presser to highlight the atrocities of the Bahraini royal family against its people. The press conference comes on the 11th anniversary of Bahrain's 2011 uprising against the ruling Al-Khalifa dynasty. Yusuf Jalali reports.
As Bahrainis are marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising against the ruling Al-Khalifa regime, Bahraini rights activists in Iran are calling on their people to stay steadfast in their struggle against the regime's unjust policies.
We will never give up, and we will continue our fight for freedom and for the constitution that our nation can write that with his hand, with his people who are free, and they would like to be free forever.
Since February 2011, Bahrain has been the scene of pro-democracy protests by Bahrainis who complain about discrimination in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. The Bahraini regime has since been clamping down on any sign of dissent and has imprisoned and executed a large number of protesters. In a televised speech aired from Iran's city of Qom, Bahrain's prominent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, called for the establishment of a democratic and constitutional system to replace the Al-Khalifa dynasty.
There is no solution to the ongoing political crisis in Bahrain in the absence of a democratic constitution. The ruling Al-Khalifa regime's insistence on the policy of injustice will only open up rifts and create deep social divisions. Bahrain must be set free from the shackles of oppression.
Activists here also slammed Al-Khalifa for normalizing its ties with Israel, saying the move shows that the regime has no respect for the ideology of its people. The Bahraini rights activists say Al-Khalifa and Al-Saud are the puppets of Israel and the U.S., serving their interests in the region.
Bahrain is entering a critical stage and is turning into another Palestine. Israel is increasing its influence on the subordinate Al-Khalifa regime and is seeking to build military bases in Bahrain. This is a serious threat to the entire region, including Iran.
The Bahraini activists argue that without Israeli and American support, the autocratic regimes in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia would collapse in a few days.
Political activists here say Al-Khalifa's brutal crackdown on dissent is a proof of their illegitimacy to rule the country. They say the revolution will not subside until the Bahraini royal family relinquish power on the grounds that it does not represent the majority of Bahrainis. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Russia's foreign minister says there is still a chance of striking an agreement on security with the West as the two sides remain locked in a dispute over Ukraine. Sergei Lavrov made the remark in a meeting with President Vladimir Putin. The top Russian diplomat suggested continuing and ramping up diplomatic efforts to resolve the standoff, but not indefinitely. In another sign of a potential easing of tensions, the Russian defense minister told Putin that some of the massive joint military drills with Belarus were wrapping up. Moscow seeks security guarantees against NATO's eastward expansion, including a permanent ban on Ukraine's accession to the military alliance. It also denies Western accusations of planning an invasion on its neighbor. The U.S. says it will temporarily relocate its embassy in Ukraine. Russia has issued a stern warning to any intruding vessels after it accused a U.S. submarine of violating its waters in the Far East. A senior Russian military official says the country is prepared to open fire on foreign ships and submarines that illegally enter its territorial waters. Stanislav Gachimagomedov has noted that any such decision would have to be made at the highest level. On Saturday, Moscow said one of its naval vessels had chased away a U.S. submarine in Russian waters near the Kuril Islands in the Pacific. The military said it used, quote, appropriate means to force the intruding vessel out of its waters after it ignored a request to leave. Russia's defense ministry summoned the U.S. military attaché over the incident. The U.S. has denied carrying out military operations in Russia's territorial waters. The Taliban object to Washington's decision to return only half of Afghanistan's funds in the United States. The group says it will reconsider its policy towards the U.S. if those funds are not returned in full. The Taliban statement says U.S. President Joe Biden will face international blame and damage relations with Afghans if he does not reverse the decision. Biden has signed an order allowing half of the $7 billion of funds to be distributed among U.S. victims of terrorism, including relatives of those killed in the September 11 attacks. The Taliban say the decision is unjustified as Afghanistan had nothing to do with the incident. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001, citing that Osama bin Laden, who masterminded the 9/11 attacks, was given refuge by then Taliban government. The U.S.-led occupation of Afghanistan ended last year, leaving the Taliban to take over once again. Political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas says the decision to keep half of Afghanistan's funds in the U.S. show pure hypocrisy of Washington, which has been pretending to care for Afghan people for a long time.
The Americans want Afghanistan to be on its knees economically and pretty rapidly because time is running out for the Americans as well. Afghanistan, of course, is in dire straits. The Americans are pulling these funds simply to make it so difficult for the government to operate that the nation collapses or the people turn on the Taliban. Essentially, they don't want the Taliban to succeed, but it's also the fact that the Taliban haven't been entirely, of course, playing ball with the Americans. Presumably, this is a way of threatening them to come into line. What they're doing by freezing these funds is targeting exactly those people and exactly those issues which they said they were so keen on supporting. So this is gross hypocrisy. It's absolutely genocidal because now they're also gleefully mentioning that by middle of 2022, about 97% of Afghans will be around or below the poverty line. So it is shocking and absolutely disgusting that the American establishment is willing to you know threaten the lives of children and women and old people who will be the first to fall.
Syria calls on the international community to help stop Israel's atrocities in the city of Al-Quds. It says the regime's brutal practices amount to crimes against humanity. A statement by Syria's foreign ministry urged the world to work to prevent further killings of Palestinians and more violations of their rights. The statement described Israel's attempts to displace Palestinians and seize their properties in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Al-Quds as crimes against humanity. The area has been a source of tensions over the planned eviction of Palestinian families there and demolition of their homes. On Sunday, Israeli forces and settlers attacked Palestinians protesting the establishment of a parliamentary office by an Israeli lawmaker there. The violence left 30 Palestinians injured. Regime forces remain heavily deployed in the neighborhood. Saudi-led coalition carries out fresh airstrikes in Yemen as the impoverished nation continues to reel from years of war and blockade. Coalition warplanes targeted a communications network in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. There were no immediate reports of casualties there. Separately, a Yemeni worker was killed and two others were injured in air raids on a water well drilling rig in Jauf province. The Yemeni army has warned that Saudi attacks will not go unpunished, hinting at further retaliatory strikes. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said Saudi Arabia cannot achieve its goals by targeting ministries and civilian infrastructure. He also dismissed Saudi claims that the Yemeni army uses civilian facilities for military purposes. Political commentator Tony Gusling says some Western countries have been backing Saudi Arabia in its war on Yemen, which is actually a devastating war against civilians.
It started all this nearly 7 years ago, this civil war, supposed civil war, but actually what it was a globalist faction, a NATO faction, a US faction, which was allowed to spawn in Yemen, and then the local people decided we're not having this anymore, and that's how it all started. So it's not really a civil war, it's a deliberate destruction of Yemen, which is being carried out by the West. This present conflict has been absolutely devastating. Of course, there are this country is the poorest country in the Middle East, and to have to suffer this, of course, has meant the deaths of many people simply through things like starvation, and of course the infamous cholera, which has been helped. So the Saudis are really saying that they are attacking military targets. Well, I'm afraid there are virtually no military targets left. We've seen civilian targets targeted again and again and again. For example, weddings, funerals, marketplaces where people are trying to buy food. These are not military targets. The UN has been forced to pull out its human rights monitors at the end of last year, around about October 2021. And guess what? The Saudis have taken advantage of this by using the excuse to kill more and more civilians. So the death rate of civilians in Yemen has doubled since October 2021.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United States' past telephone call records and missing documents hinder the House panel as it tries to piece together what former President Donald Trump was doing during the attack on Congress. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater, Jonathan Martin, Maggie Haberman, and Michael Schmidt. The piece is titled, Trump's Missing Call Logs Present a Challenge for January 6 Investigators. The House Committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol has discovered gaps in official White House telephone logs from the day of the riot, finding new records of calls by President Donald J. Trump from critical hours when investigators know that he was making them. Investigators have not uncovered evidence of any official records were tampered with or deleted, and it is well known that Donald Trump routinely used his personal cell phone and those of his aides, to talk with other aides, congressional allies, and outside confidants, bypassing the normal channels of presidential communication. But the sparse call records present a major obstacle to a central element of the House panel's work, recreating what Donald Trump was doing behind closed doors during the assault on Congress by a mob of his supporters on 6th of January 2021. The gaps in the call logs were the latest in a string of revelations this week about the extent of Mr. Trump's flouting of the rules and norms of presidential conduct, and how his penchant for doing so has left an incomplete record of how he operated while in office. Some of the records that the January 6th committee has received had been ripped to shreds and taped back together, reflecting the former president's habit of tearing up documents. In addition, Donald Trump removed more than a dozen boxes of presidential records from the White House when he left office, which the National Archives believes contained classified material, according to a person briefed on the matter. The House Oversight Committee on Thursday, 10th of February, announced an investigation into what it called potential serious violations of the Presidential Records Act. Donald Trump has been loath to return the boxes of documents he took from the White House, despite repeated efforts by the National Archives to obtain them. At some point during a months-long negotiation between Mr. Trump's team and the agency, officials at the National Archives threatened to send a letter to Congress or the Department of Justice if he continued to withhold the boxes, according to a person familiar with private discussions who spoke about them on condition of anonymity. And while he was president, staff in the White House residence periodically discovered wads of printed paper clogging a toilet, leading them to believe that Donald Trump had attempted to flush documents, according to people familiar with the situation. He was known to do the same on foreign trips. It has been confirmed. Highly irregular practices underscore the challenge of creating a full historical record of a presidency that often operated outside of the bounds of long-standing rules. They have also prompted accusations of hypocrisy from Democrats, who recall how Donald Trump branded Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State worse than Watergate, and made "Lock Her Up" a campaign rallying cry in 2016. Republicans, who eagerly followed his lead in savaging Hillary Clinton for her email practices, have now been notably silent amid revelations that Mr. Trump spent his 4 years in office, and much of the time since, mishandling presidential records. The House panel investigating the 6th of January attack is still awaiting additional material from the National Archives and Records Administration, which keeps the official White House logs. The committee has also subpoenaed telecommunication companies for the personal cell phone records of a range of people connected to Donald Trump's inner circle. It is unknown whether the committee has specifically demanded records from Donald Trump's personal cell phone. The call logs obtained by the committee document who was calling the White House switchboard and what calls were being made from the White House to others. Two people familiar with the phone records discussed details about them on condition of anonymity because they did not want to be identified discussing an ongoing congressional investigation. A spokesman for the House committee declined to comment. Since the attack on 6th of January 2021, former Trump administration officials have said that investigators would struggle to piece together a complete record of Donald Trump's conversations on that day because of his habit of using his and other people's cell phones. At least one person who tried to reach Donald Trump on his cell phone on 6th of January 2021 had their call picked up by one of his aides. It is unclear where Mr. Trump was at the time. Counterintelligence officials say it is highly risky for presidents to use their personal cell phones, as those phones almost certainly have no protection against spying by foreign adversaries. There is nothing in federal record-keeping laws that explicitly addresses whether a president can use a personal cell phone for official business. But the spirit of the law is that presidents should avoid doing so, and if they do, their court should still be memorialized, said Jason R. Barron, the former director of litigation at the National Archives. Jason R. Barron added, government agencies are supposed to document phone calls when the conversation is about important government business. Professor Barron, a professor at the University of Maryland, added, a president choosing to use a personal cell phone on a sensitive matter of government business without the conversation being recorded anywhere raises serious questions about his compliance with the spirit of the Presidential Records Act. Little is known of what Donald Trump did inside the White House as rioters stormed the Capitol building. He was watching television as the riot played out on cable news, and several aides, including his own daughter, Ivanka Trump, implored him to say something to try to get the rioters to stop. Nevertheless, his first public communication as the melee unfolded was a Twitter post attacking Vice President Mike Pence, who was presiding over the joint session of Congress to count the Electoral College votes. Mr. Trump also is known to have tried to reach out to one senator as a certification of the vote was delayed, and he fielded a call from Representative Kevin McCarthy, the top House Republican, who told Donald Trump that people were breaking into his office on Capitol Hill. Early on in his administration, Donald Trump was known to use a cell phone belonging to Keith Schiller, his personal bodyguard at Trump Tower, and later on the director of Oval Office operations, for some of his phone calls. It meant the White House call logs were often an incomplete reflection of Donald Trump's contacts. After the Supreme Court ruled against Mr. Trump's efforts to block the release of hundreds of pages of presidential records, the National Archives turned over to the House panel investigating the riot voluminous documents that included daily presidential diaries, schedules, appointment information showing visitors to the White House, activity logs, call logs, and switchboard shift change checklists showing calls to Donald Trump and Mike Pence on 6th of January. Despite the lack of call records from the White House, the committee has learned in recent weeks that Donald Trump spoke on the phone with Mike Pence and Republican lawmakers on the morning of 6th of January 2021, as he pushed to overturn the election. For instance, Mr. Trump mistakenly called the phone of Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, thinking it was the number of Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama. Mike Lee then passed on the phone to Tommy Tuberville, who said he spoke to the former president for less than 10 minutes as rioters were breaking into the Capitol building. But many of the calls the committee is aware of did not show up in the official logs. The committee did receive evidence in the documents requested from the National Archives that Donald Trump had a call with Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, who led the floor strategy on 6th of January of objecting to Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory in key states, according to two people familiar with the investigation. Jim Jordan has said he spoke with Donald Trump multiple times on that day. The Washington Post reported on Wednesday that Justice Department officials were weighing whether to investigate Donald Trump after the National Archives made a referral to the Justice Department asking it to examine Donald Trump's handling of White House records.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. On the threshold of the birthday anniversary of the Command of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the first infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, let us contemplate on a brief but bright aphorism from him. People perish due to two things: fear of poverty and seeking of pride.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'in rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We are looking at the justice of Ali alayhi as-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam, when he became a ruler, he came a ruler under the condition that he serves mankind, that he serves humanity. That was his condition. He says, I only become a ruler and a leader if you allow me to apply justice to you. Unlike anyone who preceded him or anyone who came after him. And you can see that through the sermons and the sayings and the speeches that he gave during assuming the office of Khilafah and leadership. In a sermon, he was quoted saying, I swear by God that in the first instance, I myself obey these commands of God, which I invite you to obey, and I myself refrain from those things from which I ask you to refrain. And he could not put it any simpler and any more beautiful or any more eloquent than this. Any leader, any person in power, if he wants to seek power and he wants to be in position and wants to apply justice, it has to apply to him first before anyone else. Ali alayhi salam simply saying to them that when I am in position of power, what do I want you to do? Treat the poor very well, give him wealth, I don't know, pay your charity, pay your zakah, pay your sadaqah, help one another, do this, do that. And he said, these things which I am ordering you to do, I swear by God, I will be the first to apply them. Because if Ali alayhi salam does not apply these things, they become just empty words. Like we say, you can talk the talk, but can you walk the walk? So Amir al-Mu'mineen says, I will lead you by an example, that when it comes to applying the things that I order, I will be the first to apply. When it comes to me telling you not to do things, I also will be the first to tell you not to do it. And you can see this is a concept that only Ali alayhi salam applied during his rule. All the rulers, all the kings throughout the history of mankind, wherever rules are set for the citizens, you will see they are the first to break. Not the last, they are the first to break them. They ask people to do things, but they never do it themselves. They command people not to do things. They forbid things on people. And you see, they are the first to break these things and do it themselves. So it is halal and haram, right and wrong for the citizens, but not for themselves. These laws, the constitution, does not apply to them. They can steal. They can take whatever they want. They can cause corruption. People can't. They can. Now, that is not how Ali alayhi salam envisioned himself being in this position of khilaf or leadership. He made it very clear. I am one of you. Whatever applies to you applies to me. And wherever I tell you, I will be the first to do. Whatever I tell you to refrain from, I will be the first to refrain from. Let us take a short break, then we continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, on this basis, the rule and khilafah is not to be obeyed in his personal capacity. It's not for him to enjoy. It's not for him to benefit from. It is necessary to obey him because he enforces equity and justice and the law of Sharia to all, which is a big difference between being obeyed for him himself on a personal level, that I am the king, I am the ruler, obey me. This never was the intention or the mission of Ali alayhi salam, and we can see that through the way he lived. He lived a simple life where he never was referred to as a leader or a ruler. He said to them, you can call me Khalifatul Muslimin, the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, a title given to him by the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and that's it. Not a king, not any other titles. So he was just a simple. But it was necessary for the people, though, to obey Amir al-Mu'mineen, and the pretext that he is there to enforce justice, to enforce the laws that guarantees the safety and welfare of people. This is what he wants. He says, if I come and ask you to do something that is for the benefit of people, then you must give me obedience, not for me, but for what I'm trying to enforce, for what I'm trying to do. And everything that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salamullah did was for the benefit of the citizens and the Muslims of his time. And he set an example for everyone to follow. Therefore, rulership or the Khilafah does not entitle the ruler and the caliph to appropriate to himself as much as of the property of the public treasury as he likes, because he is in command, in control of the treasury of the Muslims. It doesn't give him a right to appropriate anything that he sees in the treasury to himself, which those before him did and those after him did. Some of them saw it as their personal treasury, not the Muslims' treasury. One of the reasons the third was killed, Uthman ibn Affan, is the fact that he gave the treasury in the hands of Bani Umayyah and Bani Marwan, which were his relatives, his nephews and cousins. They were using the money of the Muslims for their own pleasure. He, or Bani Umayyah, or Bani Marwan, they had absolutely no right to take one single dime away from the wealth of the Muslims and use it for their own. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, his time, he never let that happen. Even to the extent when people visit him, if it's personal visit, he would use his own candles. He would not use the candle of the treasury of the Muslims. So look at the justice of Ali and the justice of those before and after him. There's only one Ali that came into existence. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.
A miniature bull in Germany's Bavaria is proving that size does not matter, as the small bovine makes himself comfortable in his new herd at an animal sanctuary. This tiny bull had a lucky escape and was rescued from a farmer who was taking him to a slaughterhouse. The mini cow is named Napoleon and was born with a genetic defect. Just 8 months old, the diminutive bull has already reached his full size. Napoleon might be small, but he is mighty and daring, as he is not afraid of joining a herd consisting of big and huge animals.
Napoleon belongs to the Dexter breed, which produces rather small cattle anyway. They grow up to be about 1.2 meters. With his 80 centimeters, he's of course far below that. Despite his size, he feels like a complete bull and is in a good mood. He has settled in with us very quickly, which we are very happy about. He also has a lively effect on the herd.
The little bovine now lives with 100 other rescued livestock. His rescuers say he gets along with other animals and has already become friendly with another rescued cow. The Dexter is a breed of cattle first originated in Ireland. They are usually bred for high-quality meat and milk. An Indonesian man frees a crocodile of a tire that was stuck around its neck some 6 years ago. Tilly, a self-taught rescuer and resident of Central Sulawesi province, captured the reptile and cut the tire using a small saw with the help of some locals. The animal had been too smart to be trapped. Tilly says he had been tracking the reptile for weeks using a basic trap with a rope tied to a log. He used live chickens and dogs as bait to lure the reptile. The crocodile drew the sympathy of local residents who worried the tiger would choke as it grows in size. Tilly says his main motive was to help animals, claiming it was not his first experience dealing with a crocodile.
Biologists in Peru release two birds back to their natural habitat after weeks of efforts to attend and conserve dozens of animals affected by an oil spill. Two birds were among some 200 animals found dehydrated and were brought to a veterinary hospital for treatment. Veterinarians, biologists, and volunteers have been leading the cleanup operation of the affected coast close to the capital, Lima. So far, several species have been released after rehabilitation. An oil tanker off the coast of Peru was hit by waves triggered by a volcanic eruption miles away in Tunga in January. Some 6,000 barrels of oil spilled into the ocean that polluted waters and beaches along Peru's Pacific coast.
There are all sorts of peculiar restaurants around the world, but not so many prison-themed eateries. One of them is in the Iranian capital, Tehran, and it is thriving.
The setting is engaging. If we want to suggest it to someone, it's because of the setting, too. It's like a cell, both its title and the story of the owners. They wrote here they were inmates themselves and why they were in jail.
Cell 16 serves its customers in cells where they can wear mock prison uniforms. The owners say they got the idea for their diner while they were behind bars for debt. They say they are now open to help newly released inmates who find it hard to get employed and give out part of their proceeds to pay for debt inmates.
There have been several cases where an inmate came and worked here while on leave, and we helped and offered him money to help his problem.
The eatery was opened in 2016. The owners have now expanded their business and own two diners in Tehran and another in the central city of Isfahan. They say they are using their emerging restaurant chain to raise funds to free convicts who are serving time for unpaid debts.
A German man has claimed a new Guinness World Record in hula hooping. Kia Sandmeier set a new record for the longest duration of hula hooping in a plank position. He was able to carry the activity in this difficult pose for over 6 minutes. The 30-year-old says he practiced the plank rigorously in the morning and evenings before and after work. Sandmeier says holding the plank was the most difficult part. The previous record for this activity was set last year by an American with just over 3 minutes. Every year, the Copenhagen Light Festival transformed the winter cold and darkness of the capital city into a celebration of light art in Denmark. In February, the entire city becomes the stage displaying captivating lighting installations presented by Danish and international artists. The works are planted at more than 30 historical sites, canals, and squares, among other urban spaces. Building facades are also decorated with special lighting designs. The organizers and curators of the festival say the event is important because it gives people a chance to rediscover their own city. Also, the event brings life to a dark season that's normally very quiet by offering joyful experiences for locals and tourists alike.
The
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
As the 2022 Winter Olympics have begun in the Chinese capital, Beijing, two playful giant pandas at the Moscow Zoo have come to the spotlight for predicting the outcome of the sports event. On the eve of the Winter Olympics opening, Ru Yi and Ding Ding were each offered five traffic cones labeled with national flags of the participating countries, represented by the largest numbers of athletes. The cones that got taken down by them were considered as the winners. The pandas then chose the cones with Chinese and German flags on them. Zoo officials say no treats were placed inside the cones to ensure that the prediction is unbiased. The zoo says it plans to continue the panda prediction for all individual and team competitions at the Games. The 15th edition of the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up. As Salman Khojouri reports, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. Here's more.
The 15th Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up its work. The four-day event brought together representatives of different sectors active in tourism and handicrafts fields, including airlines, cruise lines, hotels, museums, travel agencies, insurance services, travel and tourism facilities, and masters of handicrafts. The exhibition is considered as the most appropriate platform to optimize face-to-face communication among the involved industries. From a tourism point of view, Iran enjoys two important and unique features. The first one is Iran's exceptional geographical location among countries in the world, and the second feature is its tourism attractions of historical, cultural, natural, pilgrimage, adventurous, and other sorts.
Qalamzani, or metal engraving, is an Iranian ancient metalwork art. It is engraved by chisels and hammers on different metals such as gold, silver, copper, brass, and some alloys. Its origin dates back to almost 7,000 years ago. It is the art of carving superb designs on various metals. The artistic work of this course made by the artists are the glorious and undeniable indication of previous metal work of Iran, and in particular Isfahan.
I'm from Hormozgan province, south of Iran. Handicrafts have always been an integral part of Hormozgan province due to the rich culture and special customs of the region. Hormozgan province embraces scenic islands, among which Kish, Hormoz, Hengam, and Qeshm are the most beautiful ones and top tourist destinations in southern Iran.
Iran has globally registered 11 cities and 3 villages under their native handicrafts during the past 6 years, making the country a world leader in registering local productions. There are totally 602 handicrafts fields identified on a global scale. 299 fields are special to Iran, from which 199 fields are in the central Iranian province of Isfahan.
With 14 entries, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council, as China with 7 entries, Chile with 4 entries, and India with 3 ones come next. Salman Khojouri, Tehran.
Joyous festive mood in East Asia as the region welcomes the Lunar New Year with celebrations, including light and lantern decorations of homes and public avenues. People across China are staging a variety of events to mark the New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. Several cities have held breathtaking light shows, with many landmarks and skyscrapers dazzling with colorful images. In the capital, Beijing, the light shows feature elements of the Winter Olympics as the city is getting ready to host the International Games this week. Elsewhere, Malaysians welcomed the Year of the Tiger with an underwater lion dance performance in an aquarium in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. The citizens have welcomed the return of the annual event, which had been called off the previous year due to COVID-19 restrictions.
A lot happier as compared to during the lockdown period where you're alone and you do things alone. You feel very lonely, right? Now that you get to be in touch with your family, yeah, it's a lot better.
Even though we still keep a social distance, but however, I feel the freedom to go out and visit and do the things that I like to do.
Celebrations are also underway in Hong Kong, Taiwan and Indonesia. The Lunar New Year, seen as a time of reunion and rebirth, is celebrated by more than 2 billion people worldwide, especially amongst Asian communities. The festivities last for over a fortnight.
Stunning light shows and hanging lanterns have illuminated cities across China to welcome the new Lunar Year, also called the Spring Festival. The city of Zigong has taken the spotlight with a sea of lanterns, turning it into a scene straight out of a fairy tale. The city is famous for lantern making and brings a festive mood this time around every year. The lanterns are usually made in all kinds and shapes, including legendary creatures representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, which is decorated vividly on special couplets. The New Year festivities officially begin on Tuesday and will continue for 15 days. The Lunar New Year is considered the largest migration of people in the world, as millions travel back to their towns and villages to mark the event.
Sub-zero temperatures in the Midwestern U.S. haven't held anglers back from participating in the world's largest charitable ice fishing contest. Some 10,000 people from across the world gathered in the state of Minnesota to put their ice fishing skills to test. They dug thousands of holes in Gull Lake in a matter of hours. Some $200,000 in prizes were up for grabs in the contest. The volunteer-led annual event has so far raised about $4 million for 67 charities since it was first held in 1991. Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
Many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired, and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Make
making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have in many cases risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world.